Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, The Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Tuesday, May 20th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman.
And we are going to start this morning by talking about the temporary protection status of Venezuelan immigrants, which has been removed by the Supreme Court. Or rather, they have granted Donald Trump permission to remove the TPS protections from Venezuelans. Sarah, do you want to set this up for us?
Sure. So temporary protected status is a lot, unlike a lot of terms in immigration law, it is exactly what it sounds like. It's a temporary status that is a combination of a decision by the State Department and other branches of the executive that it's not safe for people to who are already in the United States to return to their country of origin. And you see this a lot of times with natural disasters or civil unrest that's particularly problematic. Some countries are granted TPS status and then it just keeps getting renewed time after time after time because it's still not safe for the people who are in the United States to return to their country of origin. It does not provide a permanent path to citizenship. So you have to find another way to get citizenship. And it's temporary, so it has to be renewed on a regular basis. You can work typically while you're here on temporary protected status. You have to apply separately for employment authorization. But this follows, of course, the deportation of Venezuelans to a horrible prison in El Salvador. And it seems that with that tied up in all kinds of lawsuits at this point, that stripping TPS, which is statutorily well within the power of the executive, as the Supreme Court has affirmed, that's another way to hasten the removal of Venezuelans from the United States. I have to point out that a lot of this is politicized. It depends a lot on what the State Department's view of a particular country is at any given moment. And, you know, for reasons, Donald Trump has Venezuela on his list of targets. So that's why we're seeing this come up. And, I would imagine that because he's having a hard time deporting as many people as he'd like to, that we can see challenges to other countries under temporary protected status going forward, especially given, I think it was last week or the week before, I lose track under Trump administrations because it's like every single week there's at least one or two things. But the end of temporary status of another kind for Afghan evacuees. So just another way that the executive has a lot of power in immigration and another attempt by the Trump administration to deport as many people as possible.
The decision yesterday will strip 350,000 Venezuelans of their TPS, their temporary protected status, and in the high court order appears to be the largest action in modern American history, stripping any group of non-American citizens of their immigration status. Teresa?
Yeah, so I read in the story that Sauer, the Solicitor General John Sauer, told the justices that, and I'm reading this, people affected by ending the protected status might have other legal options to remain in the country because of the, quote, decisions to terminate TPS is not equivalent to final removal order. But to me, that raises the question of whether or not the Trump administration has any real infrastructure for properly processing these folks, because I know when the Biden administration tried to get increased funding to do that, to process people, to make a actual due process determination, they couldn't get the bill passed that had that funding. And so, and I couldn't find anywhere whether or not they are funding this. I see where they're funding detention centers and such. But do you know if they're funding any processing, Sarah?
Or? Well, in fact, they're firing people That's who would saw. Process claims, including immigration judges. So typically, a removal order is issued by an immigration judge because there are still some vestiges of due process in the immigration system where the executive will acknowledge it. There should be more. They should be better protected. But in this country, we detain and deport first and ask questions later. So, you know, this is a deliberate move by the Trump administration to reduce the number of decision makers that we have so that they can deport as many people as possible. It's harder to get back into the country once you've been deported. The Solicitor General is not wrong. There may be other paths for folks. This is another, when the President of the United States makes a very public showing of what will happen to you if you are taken into custody by the federal government, i.e. you'll be sent to a human rights violation, just open and notorious, place for a scary, scary place for people to go to, then people tend to avoid that at all costs, meaning people will likely, some people may choose to voluntarily depart, which you can take in lieu of a final removal order. It has fewer consequences it has a shorter timeline for when you can reenter the country. And it means people can leave on their terms as opposed to the government's. Allegedly, theoretically, who knows what he'll do?
I check always on when I'm going to be on what's happened on this day in history. And in 2018, that's when Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela won his second term, and now and under questionable circumstances, right? And there were boycotts, suggestions of vote rigging, and now he's won again. And so the situation hasn't improved in Venezuela; it's only gotten worse. And so it's this issue in the United States of due process is obviously one that this administration, it's parts of the Constitution. Again, as I say, it's Constitution's not supposed to be a suggestion, but to this administration, it seems to be. The other thing I think, and you mentioned it, that I've been really concerned about is this Department of Homeland Security announcement of the Afghanis have to leave. And to me, this is the same group of people who constantly denigrated President Biden and his administration for how the U.S. left Afghanistan and specifically talked about how we left behind people who helped us. And so those people who did get here after helping us, they're now saying that they have to leave and go back to Afghanistan, which I think I'm just amazed at how little attention that has gotten, as well as this notion that there are another 500,000 Haitians who should be returned to Haiti at a time when we know that, Haiti is in quite a disarray, is putting it politely. I wonder, what is all this costing us? What is the process costing us in terms of real dollars? And what is the lack of process costing us in terms of adherence to our Constitution and how we're seen in the world? And the last thing, that Trump for a long, long time has talked about Venezuela, and I too don't understand what his thing is with Venezuela, but he constantly repeats this trope that the Venezuelans emptied their jails and mental health facilities and sent all those people to the U.S. with zero evidence that that ever happened. It didn't happen. There's no evidence it happened in Venezuela. There's no evidence it happened in the Congo or the three or four other places. And yet the media repeats it and doesn't, every time he says it, they should say, where's the evidence? Because what it does is scare people. And it's done with no evidence. So in any case.
Absolutely. And you mentioned two oil-rich countries, Congo and Venezuela, resource-rich, I should say. So I suspect that there's a connection between Trump's friends and their interests and then his decisions about these countries, his friends being Putin and other dictatorial regimes.
Mark?
So Well, I guess there are two issues I want to just briefly mention. One is Venezuela itself, and then this order and how I think it talks about where the Supreme Court's going to go for the remainder of Trump's term. On Venezuela, it's interesting if you think about the Biden administration and the last election down there in Venezuela. Biden administration, to my estimation, intentionally gave the Venezuela government the benefit of the doubt and took all sanctions off, started to sort of make nice in order to keep oil prices down and increase their chances of having a Democrat reelected. So the Trump is not the only one who's played footsie with the Venezuelans historically. Not that either of them should be, frankly. I'm not defending Trump when I say that. I'm just saying we should be more broadly aware of what happens politically. I think that idea of being more broadly aware is also helpful to explain what I think we're seeing with respect to immigration. The populace in America decided, particularly when it could see within cities that it hadn't seen them before, immigrants on the street, decided that it really did hate our immigration policy, or at least I should say the way we ran immigration. Regardless of policies, they hated the effect of our policies and how it was being run. And they gave Trump a lot of support. Arguably, it was his second best issue in the election. And he is facing all sorts of lack of success on other measures. This is the one where the public generally is, I guess, less worried by what he's doing. And I think we shouldn't underestimate how much he, Stephen Miller, Christine Noem believe that this is pandering to his base and the racism that he stokes and the division that he stokes. And if there was any doubt, just look at the Afrikaners that he's let in and the ridiculous justification for that. If that isn't just race baiting, I don't know what is. Now, if you look at this specifically, my understanding is, and it's interesting to note that Ketanji Brown Jackson was the only dissent here. My understanding is it is the purview of the executive to turn on and off these stays of deportation for these large classes. And the Supreme Court basically, I think in this case, and I think we can expect for the remainder of Trump's term, I think it will defend the other two branches' authority rigorously. But I think in doing that, it's going to give Trump a pretty free hand in terms of executive powers and what he does with them. And I think this is a clear example of that.
You're the expert, but
go ahead, Teresa.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, I don't disagree that he has the authority to determine temporary protective status. The executive has that authority. The part that I have trouble with is the next part, which is the due process part, that they are afforded, and even his own Solicitor General said that they should be afforded due process, and they've given no evidence that they are going to afford these folks due process. And the question is, why would you suggest that it's now safe to go back to Haiti? Is there any evidence he has the right to say it is, but is there any clear evidence that says right now it's safe to go back to Haiti? I don't see it. Venezuela, probably not, but certainly not Haiti. And how could you in good conscience say to those folks from Afghanistan who they came here, not nearly enough as should have gotten out, have gotten out, so they get out, they get here, and they get here because they helped Americans during the war, right? And now he's saying that they no longer have protective status. They haven't been processed because of the backlog, because there aren't people to do it. And I also think that the reason that he riled up Trump, effectively riled up his base, is because he scaremongered people. He said things over and over that weren't true, like the Venezuelans empty out their prisons and jails and made people believe that it wasn't safe to walk down the street because they were going to get killed by immigrants, when there's very little evidence of that. So he did it by scaremongering. Well, I mean very, very, very effectively, no doubt about it, but he did it by scaremongering.
Teresa, I don't disagree that the assertion by the Solicitor General that there are other means of redress is a weak fig leaf when you're taking hundreds of thousands of people and dumping them trying to dump them back into Venezuela, I think we should expect that very few, if any, find success in other avenues. And I do agree that part of the reason the assault on irregular immigrants has been so effective is because it's been coupled with an erroneous assertion that we are left safe because they're in this country, which is just statistically not true. They commit crimes at a lower rate than citizens. So if we're willing to, if we really want to make the country a lot safer, then we should all leave and leave the irregular immigrants here, and it'd be actually a safer nation than it is.
We are discussing kind of a lot of immigration stories in the United States this morning, starting with the Supreme Court allowing President Trump to strip legal protections from 350,000 Venezuelans in the country. We are also now going to introduce the topic of the Justice Department has charged a New Jersey congresswoman with assaulting federal agents during a clash outside a Newark Immigration Detention Center, and they dropped a trespass charge against the city's mayor that arose from the same episode. Alina Haba, the interim U.S. Secretary for New Jersey, disclosed the move, saying that the congresswoman, LaMonica McIver, has been charged for assaulting, impeding, and interfering with law enforcement when she visited the detention center with two other Democratic members of Congress from New Jersey on May 9th. Sarah.
Yeah, so the Trump administration is pushing how far it can go, not just for the due process rights of immigrants, but the due process rights of Americans. So now we see a creep into a couple of issues. You might remember back last month, the Trump-led FBI arrested a state court judge from Wisconsin, Hannah Dugan, for what they claim was obstruction of justice when she referred ICE officials to the administrative unit of the courthouse and then allowed a defendant in her courtroom to used a separate exit from the building. He was ultimately apprehended by ICE agents shortly after he left the building, but she was charged with obstruction of justice. And last week she was in, she had a hearing and was indicted by a grand jury. So there's also a case in Boston from the first Trump administration of a Boston state court judge. President Biden dropped the charges against her, similar facts, but the Massachusetts Judicial Ethics Committee is still noodling her case, which is like 7 years old now, but that's going to come up this summer. So we're looking at whether Trump can use immigration to also start silencing and targeting elected officials, including judges, and in New Jersey, other electeds who he disagrees with philosophically or who might be political enemies. And that is something that I think groups like the Federalist Society should be really concerned about. You know, what happened when the conservatives and libertarians really hold dear this idea of state sovereignty and state rights and the separation, you know, the avoiding the big feds coming after state governments. This is laying a really dangerous precedent down the road for Republicans when the executive can start targeting state actors for free speech or for ideology. So, you know, it doesn't the criminal charges will probably be easily dismissed, but the damage is really in the message that Trump is trying to send to everyone who disagrees with him, including judges and elected officials. No one is safe.
That was Sarah Rogerson on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, May 20th. We'll be back with more after this break.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, May 22nd, Joe was joined by Stort Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, Executive Director of Communications for Local Power and former White House Advance Lead Anna Markowitz, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio.
All right, let us begin and say this to you. The House has approved Donald Trump's massive tax immigration package. The legislation would extend tax cuts and add billions in new spending and trillions in debt. There were holdouts. There were a lot of meetings between the president and those. He went to Capitol Hill. Also, he spoke with those who were holding out yesterday in a long meeting to talk to those. And so, this the bill is formally known. People got mad at us yesterday for calling it this as if it were an editorial. But the bill is formally known as the Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill. That's what it's called. I can't change that. I'm sorry. It extends trillions of dollars in tax cuts from his first term, along with new campaign promises, including no taxes on tips and overtime wages, and hundreds of billions of dollars in new spending. But the legislation, which passed 215 to 214 after marathon talks, carries a hefty price tag. The latest projection from the Congressional Budget Office, lawmakers' nonpartisan bookkeeper, showed it will add $2.4 trillion over 10 years to the national debt, which already exceeds $36 trillion. To offset the cost, the measure would slash spending on social safety net programs by more than $1 trillion over 10 years. Even then, the mammoth legislation could also force nearly $500 billion in cuts to Medicare over the next decade to keep the national deficit within legal limits, unless Congress later adjusts those limits. The legislation could strip Medicaid coverage from 8.7 million and lead to 7.6 million more uninsured people over 10 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office. The final vote came just before 7 o'clock this morning, wrapping up a more than 24-hour session that started in committee at 1 a.m. Determined to pass the bill to keep it on a long track to win approval. And by the way, that was 1 a.m. Wednesday, so that was going all through the day. 1 a.m. Wednesday, determined to pass the bill to keep it on a long track to win approval by July. House Republicans forced debate deep into the night as each caucus hauled in food, coffee, and other energy drinks to keep the bleary-eyed lawmakers alert and ready to go. So, Judy.
Hi, you can, you know, first of all, I'd like to congratulate the House for actually working hard. But you can bet they're all on planes headed home right now. It's hard to separate the politics from the actual fiscal implications of it. As a taxpayer, as a resident, I can't help feeling disillusioned by the whole thing. I'm worried about the debt. I'm worried about the cuts to services. And I know it's going to go to the Senate and it's going to be changed. But mm-hmm. the overall thrust of it seems like it's bad for the debt and it's bad for services. Now, you know, the devil's in the details. Let's see what these Medicaid cuts actually mean. But from the get-go, I'm seeing a ton more paperwork requirements or application requirements. And it seems like that's going to add to the federal bureaucracy and not going to be efficient. I appreciate the need to hold people receive government services accountable, but it just seems like these are barriers to receiving Medicaid. And then, if anything, we've been building up our society to ensure more people, to give them good health coverage. And that's something Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wants. And it seems like this is going to take more and more people out of the healthcare system, and that ultimately will be bad for our society.
Anna?
Yeah. I mean, here's looking to you, Senate. Please don't pass this. But I was just very disappointed. I didn't think that they were going to pull it together. I thought more than two House members were going to vote no from the Republican side. with so many people facing barriers of needing to work, they pushed up that deadline to 2026, which is just terrible. So I'm highly disappointed. I think Hakeem Jeffries said it pretty well with his prediction that this is the moment that is going to cost the Republicans the House for the next election. I think that people are going to see the impact of their day-to-day life. They're going to see that they're losing their health care, that they're losing their SNAP benefits, that this is going to raise costs for the lowest income Americans by 2% and raise the income for the highest Americans by 4%. And like, that's just not the direction that we need to go. It's not protecting the middle class.
Robert.
Yeah, I'm kind of with Judy on this. The devil is in the details. And with Anna, you know, you got to wait and see what the Senate does. There'll be reconciliation, et cetera. So, you know, this conversation is a little bit of blue sky right now. But look, having said that, folks on the right don't like this either. You know, if you're a fiscal hawk, you are, you know, livid about $4.1 trillion, I think, in revenue loss. You're upset about a nearly $5 trillion deficit hike. You know, heresy perhaps to say in New York State, but is it really a good idea to add, to raise the SALT deduction to, what is it, $30,000? So
40 in the new one.
40, okay.
They had to raise it even more.
Yeah. You know, I mean, this is famously a bit of a bugaboo on the right because, and I tend to agree with this, you know, you're asking, you know, low tax red states to subsidize, pay more for the federal government, so to speak, as a share of the federal government than states like ours. So there's a lot not to like here, whether you're on the left or the right.
We talk about, Anna, you brought this up about the Senate. What do we know? What do we think of how this is going to go down?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I mean, I was surprised that it passed in the House, so I feel like I would be even more surprised if it passed in the Senate. I mean, I feel like it's easier for the first body to pass something because they can make a big statement. Whereas the second one, they're like, oh no, this is really going to become law if we do this. Let's think about this more rationally. We can't just be making political statements to get reelected. So I don't know. I hope that people think about it practically and think about the millions of people that are going to lose their benefits.
I think the political calculation from the Republicans was they're going to lose the House anyway, way in the midterms, because the fact there are so many factors against them that they're thinking they may as well go for what they can go for as long as they have the votes. I also heard that the actual margin was 2 votes, but there was one House of Representative member who fell asleep at his desk and missed the vote entirely.
No.
That's hilarious.
Oh God,
Fran Berman.
Well, I'm still waiting not to see so many pennies. Just saying. There were a lot of losers among things that I personally care about. Among them were, you know, universities and the potential tax increase on endowments. Kind of anybody depending on the government providing some sort of safety net were losers, and that includes, you know, poor people and people that use the services of Planned Parenthood. Public lands were a loser. We're going to see, you know, more drilling and mining on them. Among the winners were service members through the Department of Defense, kids with this MAGA account, that's not so clear. Mass deportation was a real winner. We're going to be funding more of that. So, you know, all in all, what worries me in the long run, I mean, look, I believe personally that the Trump administration is really stressing a system that was broken in many ways, had many cracks, many things that we were worried about. On the other side of this, whatever that is, it's not going to go back to the way it was before. And I think the challenge for us now is how do we not just regroup, but how do we move forward to do the best of what this country can do for its constituencies? And So when I look at this and it continues to demolish safety net, demolish education, demolish our value for our resources, we better get cracking, because the local will be all about who votes for what and whether things get through and what Congress looks like next time around. But on the other side of that, no matter what those scenarios are, I think it's really important that we have a plan.
Fran, can I ask a question? So, you know,
I
share, you know, with your views on the safety net and whatnot, but at some point we have to be clear and make hard decisions if we're going to reduce the deficit. Well, where's that going to come from?
You know, I completely agree. And you know what I mourn, really, Robert, is that I mourn the fact that people don't seem to be able, at least not in the sort of public domain, have really thoughtful conversations about that. I mean, I do think there are philosophical differences between a big safety net and a small safety net, mm-hmm. on how we control the deficit, on where we raise money from. But when I look at the media and all of the things that I'm hearing, it really is all about winning and losing. Or, you know, who am I mad at today and how can I make them suffer? And so I would really welcome that kind of discussion, because I do think one has to be fiscally prudent.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You know, what you spend money on and how much of a safety net you need. You know, we have worked examples from all over the world, mm-hmm. and we should be thinking about what works right, what works well for America.
A minute warning.
Yeah, no, I think Judy said it quite well, you know, that this is the politics overwhelming, you know, the practical governing, as it were. My words, not yours, Judy. But look, at some point, we've got to have that hard conversation, right? We've got to make hard decisions. I think everybody agrees we can't go on like this, but nobody's willing to say, okay, here's the pound of my flesh that you can have.
But unfortunately, we're not even getting any decreases to the deficit by right. cutting these programs. He's actually increasing the deficit by lowering taxes. So somehow we're getting the worst of both worlds.
That's why this is a disappointment to everyone.
As we discuss the news of the day, including this story about the bill that was being pushed very hard by the president personally and was in some question yesterday as to whether it would pass. There were holdouts, a lot of meetings, a lot of direct appeals to congressional representatives who were saying that they had problems with it. I will note, I noted this yesterday, I'll note it again today, that most of those problems were that those who were backing off of it didn't believe that it went far enough. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that they felt it was going too far. It was that it was not going far enough. So we have some letters from people. Let's get to those. Ken says, I understand the new bill contains a provision which would defund enforcement of contempt of court citations issued against those who fail to comply with court injunctions, and that it is retroactive for orders issued before the bill has been enacted. This would seem to have far-reaching consequences for the current administration, and I have not seen nor heard any media reporting on this issue. Oh, that just sets Judy off. And my mind is boggled as to why not. Anxiously awaiting your comments. Thank you, and I love your show.
You know, I haven't heard it either, but I can let me be straight on this one. These big bills where you pack everything, including the kitchen sink, into one, what happens is you don't get a debate on a particular issue. If that's a good issue, let's debate it. Let's be up and down. Let's have every congressperson say whether or not they're for or against it. Putting everything together is the strategy in Washington to get this kind of omnibus thing passed. But what it does is negate our ability to understand what Congress is doing. What we'll find, I mean, I think this bill is 800 pages long or
right.
more.
1,100, I think.
Why
right?
Why not do your job and vote on everything one at a time? I mean, at the local level, that's what we're used to. The town board will vote on a particular issue, and we'll all get to weigh in and understand what it's happening. When you do it like this, the people don't understand. We feel like we've been hoodwinked.
Fran, anything you'd like to add?
I agree. I do think, you know, we need kind of measured, you know, I know I'm in fantasy land here, by the way. I think we need measured conversation on everything. And I do think these big bills, they hide a multitude of sins. And you know, I completely agree with that. I think it's often infeasible to get a lot of stuff done a little bit at a time. And I think we have to sort of figure out a way to kind of weigh in on those things. But, yeah, I agree with that.
Anna?
Yeah, I mean, I also agree with what Judy said. I think that it would be great if they broke it down into smaller pieces. I think people thought that they might have to in order to get it passed because there were so many contentious things in there, and people thought that they wouldn't be able to pass all of it in one bill, but they would never have broken it down into enough pieces for people to notice something like that. So it's how it's always been. It's broken. Let's change it.
You know, it's this just occurs to me now, given the enormous size of these bills. And by the way, Judy, I'm in favor of putting in a $10 billion line item for kitchen sinks, just to see if anybody's paying attention. But I think with Anna, you said
we've already gotten faucet pressure, so sure, why not?
Yeah, put it in just as a reading test. Are we really sure that this will cost the House, the GOP, the House? And here's what I mean by that. Because of the size of these bills, because none of us can wrap our head around the entirety of it, doesn't that argue for the winners and losers here are who tells the best story about this bill? So, you know, in other words, you know, and it's not my job to either, you know, cheerlead, apologize, or argue the president's brief. But it's not hard to concoct a story where this is a winner. Hey, there's $175 billion in here for border walls and deportations. Now, you might not like them, but that's a political winner. That's like a 70-30 issue. You know, hey, there's we're going to bring manufacturing back, and here's how we're going to do it. In other words, he who controls the narrative controls who wins and loses here. So while I tend to agree with you, Anna, that this is probably not necessarily going to redound to the GOP's favor, those of us who are in the business of storytelling, as it were, and I know you did some of that work politically, well, they've got things to work with here, right?
But I think that it's all well and good to have a good story be told, but if it's impacting your bottom line as a family, then you're not gonna vote just because you like more people deported if it means that you don't have health care, if it means that your SNAP benefits are reduced significantly, you can't feed your family. I think right. that
But we're assuming those things are gonna happen and we just don't know yet.
And I think part of the strategy is to delay the impact until after the midterm election. So
okay.
that is not going to be realized by the people who are casting ballots. I also think the Republicans view a loss in the midterms as inevitable no matter what happens with this bill. I think, you know, history is against them. And with the aggravating impacts of the tariffs, I think they know that it's kind of fruitless to even hope to keep the House.
That was Judy Patrick on the Roundtable Panel on Thursday, May 22nd. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, May 23rd, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
All right, let's start in on what is making news today. And there are several things that are happening. And so where should we begin? I guess we'll start with Harvard University. So yesterday, the president announced that the administration was going to move to bar international students. They said it would block current and future international students from attending the university. The news this morning, which only took about 12 hours to brew, is that Harvard University is suing the administration. This less than half a day after the Department of Homeland Security said it would block international students from attending the nation's oldest university and one of its most prestigious. The administration action and Harvard's response signified a dramatic escalation of the battle between the administration and Harvard, and the university's forceful, almost immediate response served as evidence that stopping the flow of international students to Harvard, which draws some of the world's top scholars, would destabilize Harvard's very existence. In a letter to the Harvard community delivered Friday morning, Dr. Alan Gerber, Harvard's president, wrote, quote, "We condemn this unlawful and unwarranted action," adding that it, quote, "imperils the futures of thousands of students and scholars across Harvard and serves as a warning to countless others at colleges and universities throughout our country who have come to America to pursue their education and fulfill their dreams." The lawsuit, which accused the Trump administration of a campaign of retribution against the university, followed an announcement on Thursday that Harvard's student and exchange visitor program certification had been revoked, halting the university's ability to enroll international students. The university indicated that it would also be filing a request for a temporary restraining order, asking a judge to immediately block implementation of the administration action. So a lot there. There was a lot there last night, even more this morning. Teresa, I know you have been following the story very closely. What do you think?
So, yes, I'm I went to Harvard Kennedy School for my graduate program. And, I mean, I think Harvard, I suspect, touches our lives, every one of us, in ways that we might not even think about through the research that's gone on there, the discoveries that have come out of Harvard, the people who have come out of Harvard and gone on to, you know, create and grow companies or lead our country, or, you know, four of our Supreme Court justices actually went to Harvard, which I'm, do they have to recuse themselves once this gets to the Supreme Court? I don't know, seriously. But in any case, I just find this so profoundly, profoundly disturbing, because one of the things that makes, well, for me, that made Harvard a special place was the students that I was in school with who were from all over the world. And that just enriched my education and informed my education, as I assumed it did to, you know, many other people and for generations at Harvard. And this seems like nothing more than bullying, intemperate bullying. But it comes with a very, very, very high cost, because having international students, whether it's at Harvard or a local community college or whatever, and our colleges and universities all over the country, I think is very, very important to a person's education. And for no real purpose except for they seem to, you know, clearly they're targeting Harvard for show, to change the conversation, I don't know what. But I just think that this is dangerous and costly. And you see the economic impact, I think, at Union College here locally. Their class, this incoming class, is not the size it needs to be. And so that's creating an economic problem for them. And as you lose these non-U.S. students, you're losing tremendous talent. You're losing resources. We're not making connections that we can that can be used down the line. I think it's a really costly mistake.
I am struck by that it does seem to be, okay, we'll do this, and then there's an action taken, and it's sort of watered down, and then we say, okay, well, now we're going to do this. And you just wonder how long this is going to go.
And
I mean, death by 1,000 fairly deep cuts.
Yeah, and because they won't do what we told them to do. Now, what they told them to do was turn over the records, personal information, of all of their non-U.S. students and all of their activities, anything that they've been involved in. And, I mean, it's just... It is, it's just, to me, it's a dangerous request. It's a huge overreach. For what purpose? I listened to some legal folks and read some legal folks last night who said that that the government doesn't have a case. You know, this will probably be dismissed. But even when Harvard wins, there's still a cost, and the cost is not only the financial cost, but it's the cost of these students who will be afraid to come to the United States, right? How many students around the world are making the decision to no longer come to the United States because they or their families decide that it's just not safe? What's become of us when the United States of America is a place that's not safe for young people to come and learn? And how many of our, I mean, you know, businesses, how many businesses in this country, in this region, in this country have been started by people who've come from other countries, done well, and then created new businesses in our country, right?
I mean, I think I have a couple different viewpoints on this. Number one, I always cringe at the use of governmental power on a selective basis, right? And so they're taking an authority that they have, which is the granting of student visas, which is a governmental function, and they're leveraging that against one institution, one only, saying, you know, you've failed to abide by these randomly applied rules and provide us with the sufficient information about the students who had to apply for the visa. So they had to provide that information to the government to begin with. It's very much a red herring. This is not what it's about. This is about trying to damage Harvard because Harvard is, you know, symbolic of woke ideology. And they earned that to some degree, right? They had a lot of intolerance on campus for any dissent from very, very liberal viewpoints. Very much so. In fact, there's a professor who wrote a really great piece called Harvard Derangement Syndrome, which is in the New York Times, where he really walks through the entire analysis and he says, look, did we bring some of this on ourselves at Harvard? Yes, we did. However, this is not the right solution. And it, to me, it's an abuse of governmental authority. It's like what, you know, the Chinese government did at the end of the Hundred Flowers Revolution when they begged people to say, give us your opinion. And when the opinion that they got wasn't one they liked, they locked people up, right? I mean, it's a use of governmental authority basically to impose a viewpoint or to stop free speech, which is really, really unacceptable. And I have a huge problem with it. But anyways, on the business side, yeah, you know, I mean, this is a country of immigrants, and very, very frequently you'll find that entrepreneurialism is very strong in the immigrant population. You know, it's very important that we be welcoming.
We've been talking with our wonderful panelists this morning about Harvard University suing the Trump administration just hours after the administration's move to bar international students and revoking their right to actually have those students come to the university. Heather, I had to cut you off there. Is there anything else you wanted to say?
I just wanted to say, like, I think that this is an example of governmental overreach in the highest form. I think that anytime you single out an institution and give these sort of specious arguments as to why When it's as plain as day why they're going after Harvard, right? Because it's a symbol of the so-called woke left. And I think that it's just an abuse of governmental authority. I don't care if it's the right or the left who's doing it. I think it doesn't matter. It's wrong, and it's not how government should work. And I personally, I have said many times, I don't think we should ever have to be afraid of our own government. That is part of a democracy, is you shouldn't fear your government. And this is not a good tone or tenor. And Teresa mentioned that she was a graduate of the Kennedy School. Yeah. Well, I also, you know, have a certificate from Harvard I took an online financial accounting class, and there was no liberal politics injected in the course that I took. It was very rigorous, and I feel like it was a really good course and just an example of the multitude of contributions that these institutions make. Is very helpful to me professionally to understand, have a deeper understanding of financial accounting. And it was a very well-run class, and just one small little piece of you know, all of the multitude of programs, in addition to the R&D that contributes so much, right. and you know, obviously the on-campus education. I mean, 20,000, 25,000 students a year, I think. This is a big institution. Its hands aren't completely clean in terms of, you know, being the shining example of tolerance and openness. But that's not the point. The point is your government shouldn't be able to take these kinds of actions on a one-off basis just to make a point.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Nick Rangel.
I mean, I just want to remark, having a liberal slant and being rigorous and a very good program is not mutually exclusive. Right. But, you know, Harvard is responsible for so many notable accomplishments, and particularly in the area of research, where they've developed treatments for diabetes, for cancer, even, you know, other advanced diseases. I think those type of programs are some of the first to kind of be on the chopping block when there are severe funding cuts. In the Capital Region, we are seeing kind of a chilling effect of the current administration's efforts in the space of immigration, and particularly targeting students on campuses. There's about 3,000 international students in the Capital Region. For Union College, as Teresa mentioned, it's over 10% of their student body. Mm-hmm. And that percentage increases in a lot of the advanced degree programs. So RPI in their master's and PhD programs, the percentage of international students is even higher. And so you do have to expect that if people are feeling that their investment in their in education by coming to the United States is at risk, that they could be deported in the middle of their education after spending tens of thousands of dollars because the administration is just sort of changing its priorities, that they aren't going to come here. And it doesn't have to be because they went to a protest or not a protest, right? Like, it's not like most international students are going to protest. I think it's actually the opposite. But the fear that investment is just wasted because of the whims, or because of kind of a, you know, a contest of will between Harvard and this federal administration, that itself is the chilling effect, and that is going to prevent international students from coming to the United States to study here. And I think that's a huge detriment to our education system, and also to the communities where many of those immigrants stay and become part of the fabric of the United States.
I agree. There is a huge risk in scaring off students, international students. A lot of higher education institutions, particularly not, I mean, the premiers, I think, will always have the ability to survive. They have so many applicants, but the foreign students that come in don't have the federal student loans, they don't necessarily require the same kinds of or get the same kinds of financial assistance packages. So a lot of the schools that are sort of, you know, maybe not Harvard, but next tier, and I don't even want to characterize it that way, but not as known, a lot of them are very dependent on international students financially because they fill a gap. And we do have a problem in the U.S. And globally, frankly, of a decline in demographics. So there's a lot more competition for students. The U.S. has always been known as the place, I mean, outside of maybe Oxford and some other universities in Europe, as the place to get the premier higher education. If that changes, that is a risk, to an economic risk to the country. Higher education is very frequently one of the largest employers in any community, public or private. And to the degree that we are undermining their ability to stay afloat, we are challenging local economies in many areas where they are the largest employer, higher ed and hospitals.
Well, to that point, the Association of International Educators, this is from the Times Union, estimated that for the capital region, international students spent $188 million last year, including their educational costs. If we lost all of our international students in the capital region, that's a huge loss in the economic activity and the impact that economic activity has here.
Well, I think this attack, I just to echo your point, your points. I think that this attack on the universities in general is really an attack on our economy, because universities are, you know, three core things that do in this regard, which is they really are the drivers of research in this country, research and innovation. So much of the what's next, whether it's in technology or medicine, architecture, design, climate, any direction you can think of, much of that stems from the research that's done at universities. That's why moving away from research investments in universities is a real problem. All the basic research comes out of universities. But the second thing that they do is they prepare the workforce. They prepare who's next, you know, who's going to go into, if you, and Trump says he wants to strengthen manufacturing in this country. You don't do that without universities preparing the workforces. That's why every CEO in the country should be up in arms about this attack on universities. And the third thing is, as you both say, they are often like hospitals. They are the economic drivers in the community in which they sit. Think about MIT, Kendall Square, or, you know, what's happening here with RPI. You see the difference in Troy, and if this CHIPS moves forward, if we don't lose our position as leaders in CHIPS, it's going to be a game changer for this region. And so I think that the attacking these universities is not only is it wrong, but it's a real economic mistake. I will say one thing that happened late last night, which is a California judge, they temporarily paused the Trump administration's revoking student visas. It was not the Harvard case. It was a different case that's been pending.
Yes.
But that was, I think, a very, very important decision. And now, I guess, in the world of Trump, we have to say who appointed these judges. And this judge, Judge Jeffrey White, was a George W. Bush appointed judge. But they granted a temporary injunction protecting international students who were among the thousands whose visas were revoked earlier this year. So that is a good sign. But regardless of this, this is just a temporary fix. And it sends a chilling message that you're not wanted here.
That was Teresa Bourgeois on the Roundtable panel on Friday, May 23rd. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.